Welcome to Puro Politics, the political podcast of the San Antonio Express News. My name is Gilbert Garcia, Metro columnist, and I'm joined by
business editor and columnist Greg Jefferson,
investigative reporter Brian Chasnoff.
We're recording this on the morning of Monday, February 22nd, while the city and the state are both recovering from what was a devastating winter freeze last week that resulted in more than 4 million Texans being out of power for an extended period, millions of Texans without water. You literally had people in the state freezing to death, people who needed dialysis, who had their power off and couldn't get that, their treatments. It was just a humanitarian crisis, the likes of which we've rarely seen statewide in Texas. And we're trying to kind of make sense of what happened. You know, there are a lot of questions about the Texas power grid and what effect that had on what we experienced last week. Brian, I wanted to start with you. You know, you co-wrote a story, a Sunday front page story, on what happened last week, and I just wanted to kind of get a sense from you in reporting on the story. What stood out to you as far as, you know, what happened and why it happened?
Sure. So, I mean, the way I went about reporting the story was I called up the mayor, I called up the SAWS CEO, and I just asked them what were the most momentous moments, if you will, from the entire experience. When did you realize the magnitude of what was happening? And for the mayor, Ron Nirenberg, he kind of highlighted the fact that on Sunday, you know, city leaders have been meeting around 4:30 p.m. every day for the coronavirus briefing, before the coronavirus briefing, to get updated. And right. And they met that day, and they talked a little bit about the storm. And really, the only thing that was on their radar at that point were the icy road conditions and the, sure, the threat of car accidents. And Mayor Nirenberg didn't really understand what was going on until 3 a.m. Monday morning, when he was awakened by some alarms going off because some devices in his home had lost power. Yeah. And so that really highlighted just how this caught everyone off guard. I mean, why that happened was because ERCOT, the nonprofit that manages the flow of power in Texas, did not even raise this as a prospect to officials and leaders across the state that this was,
That was amazing to me. The lead of your story was basically about how Ron Nirenberg really, he got no warning. He had no idea that these so-called rolling blackouts were going to be happening across the state.
That's right. Yeah. And then another thing, another little tidbit from the story that kind of highlighted how this took people by surprise. Later that morning, just a couple hours after Ron Nirenberg was rudely awakened, CPS Energy cut power to a major pump station, a major San Antonio water system pump station near the University of Texas at San Antonio. And that's critical infrastructure, and that has an immediate cascading effect because these pump stations are interconnected. So that shut power to at least four other pump stations. And you might have heard that the folks on the far north side of the city have been kind of struggling with some of the worst of this in terms, sure, of water outages and so forth. And that's kind of where it began. And, CPS didn't alert SAWS when they did that. So that was sort of caused a lot of panic at SAWS when that happened. And Stephen Klaus, the chief operating officer at SAWS, told me that he thought the entire city was going to go dry overnight on Monday.
Yeah, and you know, the situation SAWS was dealing with, as the week went on, you had, you know, pipes bursting, and just, you know, there's a lot of repair work that's ongoing. And on top of that, they had this issue with the pumping stations that you mentioned. You know, Greg, when you look at this, because, you know, ERCOT is, I mean, they've been compared to sort of like an air traffic controller. They sort of manage the flow of power in most of the state. El Paso is a part of a separate grid. But when you look at what happened, because, you know, I certainly this was really bad freeze, very unusual for Texas. But I think it was unusual because it lasted so long. We had about, I think, about 6 days of freezing temperatures. You know, we had a couple of snowstorms. It was unusual, but at the same time, I mean, when you look at it, I think we really hit, the freezing temperatures really hit, as I remember, like the morning of Valentine's Day, which was that Sunday. And by late Sunday night, you had blackouts being mandated by ERCOT because they did not, because, you know, there was supply and demand problems happening here. And so, and I mean, are we going to look and say that people are saying, well, this never happens, or it's a once in 100-year thing. This was basically about one day of freezing temperatures and the grid collapsed. So what do you make of what
happened? So it got cold enough long enough to very quickly, you know, cripple, you know, a number of power stations, both those fueled by fossil fuels and renewables. They both were kind of hamstrung. And you had natural gas wellheads freezing up. The impact was dramatic and it came quickly. But we knew about these vulnerabilities after the winter storm in 2011. FERC, the Federal Energy Commission, the basically federal regulators, like they issued a report following that debacle, you know, in 2011, and they pointed out, you know, the fact that, you know, there was too little weatherization of not only power plants but, you know, distribution lines and other assets to get, you know, electricity to the market. And, you know, we took a very Texas approach to it and left most of it, almost all of it, all the recommendations to the power producers as, yeah, you know, an effort to volunteer. You know, there were no mandates coming out of this. I can't imagine that there won't be actual enforceable regulations following this.
Well, this is what happens. I mean, I think what we saw here was a variation on kind of a Texas sort of ethos that comes into play with all of our, you know, politics and our policy, which is this idea. Well, you know, this is you know, that thing in 2011. It's not going to happen again for a while, and we want to keep prices low, and we don't like regulation, and we don't care what the feds say,
right.
And so all these things kind of merging into saying, look, you know, we like our low prices, I think there's so much of what the state does has to do with this kind of short-term thinking. And I mentioned in the column I did last week, you know, if you really think about how we've handled public education, public health, particularly mental health services, transportation, a lot of it is, you know, we like low taxes. We just don't want to pay for this stuff. And so, you know, we... short term, everybody's happy, and then long term, we start to see the problems and the cracks.
But I also have a question. You know, overlaying all of that though is the fact that we've been living under a pandemic for a year, and I got to think that that's even in Texas. My guess is that's changing the way we think about the value of government and, you know, what it's there to do. You know, to protect people. So, I mean, it feels a little different than it did in 2011. It's, you know, I think maybe Texans are a little less cowboy minded. Maybe they might be up for a little more regulation.
Yeah, well, I think there is some change.
Didn't Governor Abbott say that Texans should never have to experience this again? So let's see if that.
Well, we'll see. Yeah.
Hey, Brian. Like, one of the things that was interesting. I mean, this was obviously a statewide crisis, and the issue with grid management. This was a statewide failure, but locally we had a particular thing happening, which was ERCOT at the state level is telling the power companies, you're all going to have to do these rolling blackouts because we're just, you know, we don't have enough supply right now. But the way that was implemented in San Antonio, it did not roll in this way where the pain was distributed evenly across the city. There just seemed to be so many anecdotes of, you know, people going 40, 50, 60 hours without power, and then other people hardly being affected at all. I mean, what's your sense about what happened? And it's maybe getting kind of technical as far as CPS Energy's explanation for that, but what's your sense about that?
Well, the easiest way to just explain this is that there are basically three different sections of the local grid, if you will.
Yeah.
One of them is critical, and those weren't supposed to have been shut down at all, although now we know that they were on Monday, at least the SAWS pump station was. But for the most part, like hospitals and other places that are deemed essential, those didn't lose power as much. And I have friends who, like, for example, one friend lives near a military base and her house did not lose power at all.
Sure.
But then you have another third of that that's, I apologize. I don't fully understand the technical nature of this, but yeah. I think Paula Gold Williams described this section of the grid as high frequency or something like that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, those didn't lose power as much. And then you have the rest of us who are on the lower third and, you know, it was just rolling blackouts but still even among that section, there didn't seem to be much rhyme or reason. My power went out a lot, but it didn't go out as much as other people's I know. So I think there's still a lot of questions about that.
Yeah. I think
that actually mine,
what were you going to say, Greg?
I'm fortunate to live next to the med center, which is considered critical infrastructure. I mean, I hate to say it because of survivor's guilt, but I didn't have a moment without power last week.
It's amazing.
But I also think it's worth pointing out that, once ERCOT started mandating cuts to CPS, and this started early Monday morning, the demands quickly grew. I mean, CPS had to cut an ever larger amount of power. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that contributed to kind of the chaos. In addition to that, you had equipment failure because of the weather. I mean, you had a lot of things going on in San Antonio with our power grid.
There are going to be a lot of, there already are a lot of questions about this and a lot of anger from lawmakers. We've seen County Judge Nelson Wolf. He sent a letter to Governor Abbott calling for a repeal of the deregulation of the electrical system that was passed in 1999 and went into effect in 2002. Lyle Larson reposted a letter that he sent to then Governor Rick Perry in 2011 calling for the abolition of the Public Utility Commission and wanting basically its responsibilities to be rolled into the duties of the Railroad Commission. So there can be a lot of questions and thoughts about this. I mean, what I would just say is when people start to assess where we go from here and what we do to avoid this ever happening, I think that the issues that really need to be looked at are, what were the effects of deregulation two decades ago? And is that something that the state really wants to continue with? Also, the state in that go it alone Texas spirit has its own grid. It is not part of an integrated multi-state grid as most of the rest of the country is. And I think the reason for this, Greg, you know, probably know more about this than I do, but I think the reason for that was, if we're not part of a multi-state grid, we're operating on our own, then we're not subject to federal oversight. So I think that is something that the ability to be able to share power with other states as part of an integrated grid, I think would have benefited Texas a lot in this situation. And the other thing,
No, I was just going to say, even though former Governor Rick Perry, he gives an interview in which he says, we're all grateful. And no, I mean, go that far. But he said we can put up with blackouts like this to avoid federal regulation.
He must have been in Cancun at the time.
We're going to talk a little bit about Cancun in a minute. But it's amazing. I think that it really speaks to the fact that Rick Perry, whatever you wanted to say about him when he was governor, I think he probably had his finger on the pulse of Texas politics. I think that statement last week reflected someone who was completely out of touch with the thinking in this. I don't think people were thinking last week, hey, 3 or 4 days, no power, freezing temperatures. It's worth it to keep the feds off our backs, The other thing I wanted to mention is the getting into the kind of market that Texas has. Basically what's called an energy only market, which means that buying power from power generating companies as you go along. Whatever you need on a day-to-day, as you go basis, you're paying for it. The thinking being that it keeps prices down. There's other states, many other states have what's called a capacity market, where you're committing long-term to buying capacity power, and this way you're kind of assuring yourselves that you're going to have that power when you need it. The argument has been that among people who don't like it is that it's more expensive. The capacity market generally allows the power generating companies they have more resources because you're committing all this money to them up front, and so they can spend more on building more power plants, hopefully maintaining their infrastructure. And I think that there was debate about this several years ago in Texas, but I think this is going to be renewed. And one of the things that is really interesting is there's now all this outrage about this price gouging that's happening because of the crisis last week. And we're hearing about the prices, which would generally at wintertime be, I think, under $50 per megawatt hour. They're now to like $9,000 per megawatt hour. What I think people need to realize is this price gouging is kind of built into the Texas system. It's just kind of part of the energy only system, where you're buying it as you go along. And if something comes up where you have a short supply and you need extra energy, they're going to charge you a lot. And it's sort of expected.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And it's a gamble. It's a risk that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to live by supply and demand, you're going to die by supply and demand. I mean, a lot of what's behind like this really dramatic spike you've seen or you saw late last week in energy prices was driven by, basically the cost of natural gas. Yeah. I mean, it went from being dirt cheap to being, thousands of dollars per cubic feet. I mean, the shift was dramatic, and a lot of our power in Texas generated from natural gas. So, I mean, that drove a lot of it. But yeah, you're right. I mean, that's, you are a slave to that kind of demand curve.
And as recently as like August of 2019, when we had, really hot summer, in August of 2019, prices went up to more than $9,000 per megawatt hour. Then, I mean, we tend to forget this, but this was a pretty recent thing, and it's happened before. And so the gamble with an energy only market is that short term prices are lower. I think with capacity market, you have greater reliability, more consistency. You're probably paying more in the short term, but long term, mm-hmm. it probably evens out and you have more reliability. I mean, I think it's at least something that the state needs to debate again and figure out, what we're going to do going forward. Greg, I also wanted to talk to you a little bit about the great column you wrote about HEB and about their ability to handle crises in a way that maybe ERCOT and other state entities could learn something from.
our state leadership doesn't have. Yeah. So, I mean, HEB has, in 2005, they put together kind of a plan to deal with hurricanes in pandemics. And they've been, they've been working on it, kind of fine tuning it since then. They have a full-time year round, basically chief of emergency preparedness. Wow. He's on staff, and full-time, has been for years. And they prepare for major weather events like this. And, they were kind of ahead of the curve last year in preparing for the pandemic. So you look and, I mean, of course shelves at HEB were pretty bare last week. Right. But I mean, the store was open and they were getting supplies in. I mean, food stuff was coming in. It's just that, with icy roads and tie ups among their suppliers, they were dealing with all kinds of, difficulties like every grocer was in town. So you couldn't get everything you wanted, but I mean, I think they performed as well as could possibly be expected given the circumstances they were encountering. You definitely can't say the same about city or the state leadership, from Greg Abbott on down. and including ERCOT, you know.
I can't remember who it was that, I mean, that said this on social media, but it was something like if HEB was like a person, like it would probably like win election, a statewide election over anybody, you know. There are a few things, yeah. A few things that people, the Texans agree on, but I think like love of HEB is pretty universal. There was also the story, which has gotten some national attention at the town of Leander, which is close to Austin. They had an incident where the power went out there and people were in line at shopping at HEB. And the people at HEB just said, just go on ahead. Just take whatever you have and just let them basically leave without paying. Because it was under the circumstances, it was more important to just make sure that people had what they needed, and is pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, you have to keep in mind HEB is, you know, they're in it to make a profit, right? I mean, like this is not a nonprofit entity, but this is a company that understands that, you know, the real test of whether you're there for a customer is in a crisis, right? So they understand, they take the long view, and they know that if they're there to help customers through a winter storm or a hurricane or a pandemic, like that will pay dividends in the future, just in terms of their reputation and in terms of customer loyalty. I mean, HEB is pretty forward-looking in that respect.
Yeah, it's among the people or entities that came out looking not so well last week, we have the junior senator from junior U.S. senator from the state of Texas, Ted Cruz. He was one of many people in the state who lost power, and on Wednesday he and his family took a trip to Cancun. I think he wanted to kind of do this pretty quietly, but the word got out. And on Thursday, he rescheduled a flight. I think the intent was to come to stay through the weekend, but he rescheduled a flight, came back by himself Thursday. There was a lot of sort of a misinformation from Cruz about it. He basically blamed the trip on his daughters, saying that they wanted to go, said he was being a good dad, was going to drop them off and then come right back. But then later he admitted that he had planned to stay with his family through the whole weekend. Brian, what were your thoughts as this story started to break? And I don't know if you were still dealing with power outages at your home at the time, but you know, a lot of Texans were. And what did you make of this when the story broke?
Well, you know that he left his poodle at home, right?
Snowflake.
And the poodle's name is Snowflake. Yeah. That, I mean, my reaction is you literally can't make this stuff up because it wouldn't be believable. Maybe it's just because I've lived in Texas most of my life and I've just been pummeled into submission, but I actually don't think that it's going to dent his career too much.
You're probably right.
I mean, it's one of those things that, national press make a huge deal of. And you know, my personal feeling was that, it ought to be a mortal wound for him, politically speaking, but it probably won't be. And I think his efforts at damage control might have insulated him from any permanent damage. I don't know. What do you think?
What do you make of it, Greg? I mean, what?
Oh, go ahead.
No.
Well, to me, I mean, the whole thing. Yeah, I mean, to me, it kind of speaks to how, you know, Senator Cruz thinks about the role of government, right? He's nakedly ambitious. He wants to, he wants to run for president. But I mean, you just get the sense from, episodes like this that he thinks about politics only in terms of gamesmanship. Right. He's not in government to do things. He's there to execute a strategy to get himself either reelected or to win the Republican nomination for the presidency. He doesn't have a list of things that a lot of politicians do that they want to accomplish in office for their home state or for their district.
Right.
For him, it's just, you know, what is going to advance his political career? What's going to enhance his prospects at the next election? And that there's really nothing more to it than that. You know, episodes like, you know, his trip to Cancun, just, you know, to me, it just underscores that, you know, even more.
Yeah, there were a lot of there was a lot of national ridicule about it. Saturday Night Live went to town with it. I think my favorite meme regarding the trip was if you like pina coladas and getting caught on a plane. But it was, you know, the thing about it is, I think Brian's right in the sense that, you know, he's not up for re-election for 3 years. The challenge for Democrats will be the challenge that they've had in the past, you know, putting up a credible candidate in a state that is will probably still be very red in 2024. I mean, one of the interesting things about Cruz is that he'll probably be running for president and running for Senate at the same time, which people can do in Texas. So that will be an interesting thing to watch. But, you know, I think that there were some Republicans who were unhappy with him. I think there've been Republicans for a while who were in Texas who were unhappy with him, but you put up a Democrat against him and then that Democrat will be portrayed as a communist and that people, even Republicans who don't like Cruz that much will in many cases, you know, hold their nose and vote for him. But I think that it did kind of play into this idea that, you know, constituent services are just not really that important to him. And a lot of his defenders were saying, well, you know what, he doesn't have any power over the grid. What could he have done this past week? And his, you know, and I think we all understand the idea that if you could get out and get away from you know, being in a home without power. I mean, I think people can relate to it, but nobody made him run for the U.S. Senate. And there were more challenges and more problems and more suffering last week than any number of, you know, than all the public servants in the state of Texas could deal with. And it just seemed that part of the job in that situation should be you stay home and you do whatever you can, whatever small parts you can play to help. And we had, people like Justin Rodriguez locally delivering blankets and water to people. We had, Beto O'Rourke doing hundreds of thousands of welfare checks with his volunteers. So it just seemed that This should be part of the job in a crisis, and I think it probably was not a huge surprise, but it did offer further evidence that that's a part of the job, as you said, Greg. That Ted Cruz does not particularly it's not particularly interesting to him, I don't think.
That we're all in it together.
Yeah, I think we're going to end things there. We hope that you all made it through last week. Okay, and that you're doing better now. And we appreciate you listening, and take care. We'll be back next week.